Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Puttock, your host today. Thank you for joining me to listen in.
The injustice of these long sentences to people who aren't violent, haven't harmed or not likely to harm others, warehousing individuals for long periods of time at a cost of $35,000 a year to the taxpayers, to me makes no sense.
That was Judge Robert Pratt, senior judge of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Iowa, commenting on the new sentencing guidelines for nonviolent drug offenders recently issued by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. An interview with Judge Pratt will be coming up soon. But first, let's hear about an upcoming opportunity to learn more about an important part of Ames local history. Alex Feehoff from the Ames Historical Society is here to tell us about it. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me today, Kay.
So we're going to talk about Pamel Court today, I believe, and there's a celebration coming up.
Yes, we're going to have a nice little lecture. That'll be on Wednesday, June 21st, at the Ames Public Library. This is put on by the Ames Historical Society. Of course, the Ames Public Library is also sponsoring. Also, the Iowa State Department of History has actually been a big catalyst behind this, really doing getting all of us involved in this project to kind of get this memory of Pamel Court, keep it still alive, since we no longer have Pamel Court around. I guess we should probably explain what Pamel Court is a little
right,
bit.
Right. I think a lot of the older residents of Ames know very well, of course.
But yeah, it hasn't been too far removed from memory here. But yeah, Pamel Court was married student housing that was on Iowa State campus on the northern edge, kind of where all the like Freddie Court and SUV apartments are today.
And that's where Pamel Grocery is.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so after World War II ended, Iowa State kind of had a real housing shortage. For the first time ever, most of their student base prior to World War I had been, 19-year-old, 18-year-old students. So single kids coming to learn. And so they were just shoving them in residence halls like you expect. But for the first time ever, Iowa State had a large population of married students coming back. So we had veterans on the GI Bill, essentially. They were getting money to come to go to school, which they were unable to do during the war years. And so they really had to figure out how they're going to accommodate. Some of these families had kids. They weren't just married, just young couples. So they couldn't just put them
in the dorms.
Yeah, they couldn't put them in Friley Hall. That just wouldn't work. They needed a little – they basically built a little town using World War II surplus buildings. So they – hauled a bunch in.
Like prefabricated.
Exactly,
building.
Yeah. So stuff that
what, like Quonset huts or something?
Yeah, some of them are Quonset huts. The original buildings were put in October of 46. They took steps to prepare. They started acquiring trailers and demountable buildings that were no longer used by the United States military. So this is World War II surplus, extra buildings they were using afterwards. And by January of 1946, the original first 36 of the proposed 150 units were set up on what was the old polo field on the north side of Pamel Drive. So that's just pretty much north of Iowa State campus where like the molecular biology parking lots would be up in those parking lots just south of the tracks there. And so they got a few of those set up and it was just kind of like a little community basically. Mm-hmm. They were really trying to make, a little town, we must say. This is kind of this was temporary housing. This was never a big long-term plan. And I'm going to put temporary in air quotes because a lot of people say that, temporary, but they lasted up until the 2000s. That's a pretty long time. And so some of them were, this is surplus. It was a little rough for a lot of the people. They were these little metal buildings. They had heat oil.
Yeah, but if you talk to people that remember, I guess there's still some around now.
Yes, no, there are plenty.
That lived there, they really enjoyed it. I mean, as you say, it was a community.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing, knowing that it was, from the people I've talked to about it, knowing that it was a temporary thing they just had to go through, I think it helped put a positive spin on it, mm-hmm. knowing that this was just something that they had to sacrifice to get their education, going to be for a few years, 2 to 4 years. And then that was going to help them get out, and get their own house, get a career started. So I think there was that sense that this is, kind of like during the war. It was like we just need to do it now because it'll be better kind of later. You know, it's amazing. I go, you know, when I go traveling around, last summer I was up in Duluth just up for a wedding, and we went down to the Shore to a museum, and I told someone I was from Ames, and they're like, oh, I used to live in Pamel Court. And so it's funny how you can really, you could probably find someone that lived in Pamel Court in every corner of this country,
uh-huh.
I bet.
Uh-huh. Okay. And tell us again when this lecture is coming up.
Yeah. The lecture will be Wednesday, June 21st. That'll be at 7 p.m. in the evening.
At the library.
Yep, at the Ames Public Library Auditorium. And that'll be with us, APL, and the ISU History Department will be putting that on. And we really encourage people, if you lived at Pamel Court, we would love to get a lot of people down there. There's going to be time for you to tell, you know, your little story about your experience at Pamel Court and how it affected you, or, you know, just we love to hear those little nuances that people take away from an experience like that. That's really the personalization of it is great.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Alex Fahoff from the Ames Historical Society. Coming up later, we'll be hearing from a young person who won a Student Volunteer Award for her work against human trafficking. That'll be coming up later in the show, so that should be very interesting, and stay tuned for that. But right now, I want to turn to a judge talking about recent guidelines issued by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Recently, Jeff Sessions issued new guidelines on charging and sentencing nonviolent drug offenders. These new guidelines severely limit judicial discretion, and they order federal judges to enforce more uniform punishments, including mandatory minimum sentences, and they instruct prosecutors to pursue the harshest possible charges. It's a back-to-tough-on-crime kind of attitude. This reverses the more moderate approach to sentencing, which gave more individual discretion to judges, an approach that was reinforced during President Obama's presidency by then-Attorney General Eric Holder. These new guidelines by Attorney General Sessions have caused a great deal of concern by many judicial experts, including Iowa Judge Robert Pratt. In this interview with Gail Seiler, Judge Pratt, who is the senior judge of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Iowa, explains why the mandatory minimum sentences guidelines seem to him a step backwards.
You've been involved in a number of clemency requests, for example, writing to President Obama and the Department of Justice to support clemency in particular cases.
Yes.
But that's something that judges don't have to do. They don't have to get involved in those kinds of things. But you've chosen to do that in numerous occasions.
I have.
Why have you made that decision?
Because the injustice of these long sentences to people who aren't violent, haven't harmed or not likely to harm others, warehousing individuals for long periods of time at a cost of $35,000 a year to the taxpayers, to me makes no sense. You're taking human capital and warehousing people for no conceivable benefit to the public or to the individual. That it's just bad public policy. And so I have a chance, you know, we have a probation office here and have long, exhaustive narrative reports on backgrounds, offense conduct, and the person. So it wasn't that I willy-nilly just wrote letters, but I would review the facts of these cases. All of the cases that President Obama gave were produced from either very unfair plea agreements or convictions and were results of mandatory minimum sentences or long guideline sentences, which I had no part in exercising any discretion. I would often tell the pardon attorneys who work these cases up for the president that the judicial branch of government has failed this person and the public. It's incumbent upon the executive branch, through use of its executive clemency powers, to correct the mistakes that we in the judicial branch have made. People often don't understand that that exercise of power, the clemency power, was given to the executive branch, that is to say the president, by our founders, because sometimes we in the judicial branch make mistakes. So I thought it incumbent upon me, having been the sentencing judge, to tell the executive branch in the person of the president, the pardon attorney, what my view was of the sentence that I was forced to give and its impact on this individual. So, you know, I had a lot of help in doing this. The volunteer part of the, there was a clemency project that many mm-hmm. lawyers volunteered to do work on these cases. So it just wasn't me. I was reviewing work that many lawyers had done, again, on a pro bono or voluntary basis to bring to the attention of the executive branch the unfair nature of many of these defendants who were eventually given some relief. I must say, however, that there are many, many others who got no relief because the understaffing of the executive clemency part of our government, the pardon attorney who works these cases up. I mean, it's not like they just send names over to the White House and he signs the proclamation granting the clemency. So it takes a lot of work to get a presidential commutation. And like I say, there are many people still in federal prison who, my belief is, they're entitled to a reduction in their sentence that probably will not get it now that the administration has changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for a year or two, it seemed like there was even a bipartisan movement to end some of these harsh sentencing policies. And also, they saw it as reducing prison costs and,
exactly.
and so on. But that hope seems to have been lost now, would you
yes,
say?
Yes, I don't see any, at least I've not heard of any efforts by this administration to bring to the attention of the president the fact that people are in prison and have no business being there, and that if we'll just advise the president of some of these people, he will take action or at least consider action. It doesn't appear that they're interested in any of that, this administration.
Some of the arguments that have been put forth in support of these mandatory sentences and this new sentencing directive are that it makes sentencing more uniform and fair, and the other argument being that these are only related to federal charges, so it only affects a small number of cases and only the kind of most serious criminals. What would you say to those arguments?
Well, if the argument is that granting judges who do sentencing, granting them discretion, undoubtedly creates some disparity, I could not argue with that. You know, there's a cliche. We're supposed to sentence the defendant, not the crime. Many people commit the same crime, but they come from very different backgrounds. And, you know, the idea that we would not consider individual statistics in exercising our discretion is kind of against common sense. Even though the guideline may be the same, that doesn't mean that a sentence for A is as appropriate as a sentence for B. Mm-hmm. You can't reduce these defendants to a computer algorithm that you just give them all the same sentence. With regard to the idea of the severity of the criminal conduct, many defendants who end up in federal court, particularly in drug crimes in both of Iowa's districts, come to federal court because local prosecutors know that the sentences that we give are much longer and harsher. Additionally, there is no parole in the federal system. If you get a sentence of 120 months or 10 years, you serve 120 months or 10 years. As opposed to the state system is always dealing with overcrowding. And so what happens in state court is while you may learn of a sentence being 10 years, oftentimes that defendant doesn't serve 10 years. He serves 2 or 3 years of the sentence and then is released on parole. So therefore, there are policy reasons why local prosecutors, state prosecutors, bring these drug cases to federal court because they get longer sentences. They're not a charge on the state. They're now a charge in terms of expenditure for prison time. And so it's, again, bad public policy, and many cases are coming to federal court that in larger urban districts never would get to federal court, and therefore the harshness of our sentencing regime is visited upon people who otherwise would be in the state system. But, you know, this discretion that we talk about being exercised by judges is more often exercised by prosecutors. Prosecutors have a great deal of discretion, as the Sessions memo that you began the conversation with indicate. They can charge or not charge, decide on charging a harsher sentence or a lesser sentence, And so the discretion that judges exercise is merely not even as great, or certainly isn't commensurate with the discretion that the prosecutor has.
And you were involved in at least one very important Supreme Court case related to this, the Gall versus the United States case. Can you tell us about that case and its significance to this?
Well, Gall was a sentencing that I had a young man from Eastern Iowa plead guilty to being involved in ecstasy conspiracy, distributing ecstasy. The grand jury returned an indictment charging a number of people, college students, police officers from Los Angeles, lawyers from Colorado were some of the people involved. It was a wide-ranging conspiracy. People were bringing ecstasy from European capitals, Amsterdam, Madrid, and distributing it throughout the United States. And the government indicted a young man named Brian Gall. He was a college student, first, I believe, at Kirkwood and then at the University of Iowa. He was distributing ecstasy and got tired of doing that and told his colleagues, I'm out of this business. Graduated from the University of Iowa, did very well in a couple of postgraduate employment opportunities, in fact, to the extent of establishing his own business. The Drug Enforcement Administration went to visit him during their investigation of the ecstasy ring. He fully acknowledged his involvement, in return for which the government indicted him. He pled guilty to the indictment. He was a very young man. I think he was 22 during the offense conduct. The advisory guidelines told me that I should sentence him between 37 and 46 months. He'd never been in trouble before, had voluntarily withdrawn from this drug conspiracy. I gave a sentence of probation to him. The government, in the form of the United States Attorney's Office, filed a notice of appeal. The Court of Appeals, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in my jurisdiction, reviews judgments of my district along with other districts. They reversed my sentence and said it was an unreasonable sentence. The standard of review for a court of appeals to review is if they determine my sentence is unreasonable, they can reverse it. They did in 2006, and then in 2007, the United States Supreme Court decided to review their decision, reversing my decision, and they said that my decision was within the discretion given to a district judge, and they ruled that institutional advantage lies with the district judge as opposed to the Court of Appeals, because the district judge sees and hears the evidence and the defendant knows more about the case than the Court of Appeals does. It does much more sentencing than the Court of Appeals. And so they reversed the Eighth Circuit and reinstated my judgment and held that the standard of review, this is really the holding of the case, is that the standard of review, you should give the district judge's decision discretion. In other words, there has to be an abuse of that discretion for the Court of Appeals to be able to come and reverse my decision. So thus far, since Booker and Gall, I believe this is the case, since Gall, now Gall is December of 07, the Court of Appeals for our circuit has only reversed two other judgments in that almost now 10-year period of time. So that was the facts in my case. I think it can fairly be said were sympathetic. I had a very nice young man. There wasn't violence involved. He had done very well after withdrawing from the drug conspiracy and was quite unaccomplished. I got a number of letters in support of his character, and I also said that he had made attempts at rehabilitation and was convinced that he could do well. And the other thing I cited, too, was the National Institute of Health had done a number of studies on brain maturity and the fact that this was before the Supreme Court of the United States had decided the cases involving juveniles. I had read a study in NIH, National Institute of Health, about brain maturity, and I cited to his youth and emphasized the youth and indecisions and difficulty making decisions and arriving at decisions that particularly immature males have. And so that was part of the reasoning that I put in my written decision. And the other thing I think that helped get the case in the posture that the Supreme Court could review it was I actually wrote a decision setting out in detail why I was giving the young man probation. Oftentimes, you know, sentencing is, as you can well imagine, a highly emotional endeavor, both on the judge's part and the prosecution's part and the defense. And so rambling words in a transcript oftentimes don't produce a result that on cold review. I mean, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court do have the luxury of looking at this in hindsight as opposed to being on the scene and having to make a judgment and decision with some immediacy. I mean, you can't have a sentencing proceeding and say, well, I'll get to it in 6 or 7 months. I mean, you have to do it relatively close to the time that the parties appear before you. So I think being able to write a decision about giving my reasons helped the Supreme Court reverse my Court of Appeals.
So that seems to be a case that supported the value of judges being able to use discretion and, as you said earlier, conscience and relying on their conscience and reason.
Yes.
So that sort of discretion now might not be possible under the new directive.
Correct, because the Attorney General's policy requires prosecutors to always obtain the highest statutory conviction they can.
That was Judge Robert Pratt, Senior Judge of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Iowa, explaining why the new sentencing guidelines for nonviolent drug offenses seem unjust and counterproductive to him. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Kay Puttock, your host today. Another tendency that concerns many people in today's polarized political climate, with its harsh, divisive rhetoric, is the apparent increase in intimidation, violence, and harassment, including online harassment. For some insight into the ways that ordinary citizens might be able to combat these violent and bullying tendencies, I spoke with Leisha Brooks, the outreach director of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. My guest is Leisha Brooks, who's the outreach director of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I've asked her to speak to us today because we're living through a time of increasingly open intolerance and intimidation. Someone who was running from our state for Congress stepped down, stepped out of the race for many reasons, but one of them that she cited was threats and intimidation. And ordinary citizens are being intimidated and bullied because of the way they dress, for wearing hijab and so on. So I'm very grateful to you, Leisha, for agreeing to talk to us today. But first of all, our listeners probably aren't very familiar with the work that is done at the Southern Poverty Law Center, where you are. You were founded, I'll just say a little bit about what I know, and then perhaps you could take over. Founded in about the 70s during the Civil Rights Movement. Your headquarters in Montgomery, Alabama, you have the site of a famous civil rights memorial, which was by Maya Lin, the artist who also created the Vietnam War Memorial. And your mission is fighting hate, teaching tolerance, and seeking justice. And I'd like you just to begin by telling our listeners some of the ways you do that.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on, Kay. One of the ways we do that is certainly through litigation. We started out as a civil rights law firm. We also promote other forms of advocacy through education and education in our Teaching Tolerance program by providing free anti-bias resources to educators across the country. And then we have a third program called the Intelligence Project that tracks and monitors hate and extremism in the United States.
Now, you yourselves, and especially your founder, Morris Dees.
Morris Dees and Joe Levin both founded the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery in 1971.
Right. He and your whole organization has been the object of very frightening threats and attempts at intimidation. yourself.
That's true. That's true. And that's very much in line with what was happening during the civil rights movement, especially when whites would stand in as allies to blacks in the struggle for civil and human rights. White people were often viciously attacked. So I say that to say point out that Morris Dees and Joe Levin are two white men that were born and raised in Montgomery, Alabama. Mm-hmm. So
now, your headquarters there, I know you have special security there and presumably your homes too, but I just wondered as how you cope sort of psychologically with what must be a dangerous job, actually.
Well, I think that most of my colleagues are a lot like Morris. I mean, we know that we're doing important work. We believe in the work that we're doing. We believe in advancing social justice, and it's, you know, our mission to advocate on behalf of society's most vulnerable people. And we recognize that there are people that don't like that, but we're taking the higher road in doing what we know is right. We do have excellent security. In 1983, our offices were firebombed by the Klan. Since then, more than 30 individuals have gone to prison for attempts to kill or assassinate our founders and or bomb our office space. But again, I mean, we are doing what needs to be done.
Right. Yeah, and that is one of the ways, in fact, that you combat intimidation and bullying is with litigation. And one of the things that I admire very much that you do is you hold the, often the people that are provoking this bullying and intimidation feel that they themselves are invulnerable because they don't actually commit the violence.
Right.
But you have managed to hold them accountable and make them bring them to court because of it. Could you talk a bit about that?
Our first case that utilized that strategy relates to the Michael Donald case. Michael Donald was 19 years old and in Mobile, Alabama, 1981. He was abducted by two men who belonged to a group called the United Klans of America. And the two men who murdered Michael Donald were found criminally liable. However, the Klan leader who set the whole plan into motion would had no culpability. No, you know, there was no recourse for his punishment until Morris came up with the legal strategy to sue the Klan leader in civil court, thereby bankrupting the organization. So, in 1987, we won a $7 million judgment in Michael Donald's mom's favor, which had the effect of shutting down the Klan, bankrupting the organization. We've since used that legal strategy a number of times, about 15 times, with other Klan groups and other hate and extremist groups across the country.
Yeah. Do you think there's any lessons or any message that ordinary citizens can take from this? You know, can you give any advice? We've had cases of, I think it was two men trying to protect a young woman from harassment on a train who were stabbed. And I believe both of them died. What can, if you're seeing someone harassed, what can you as a bystander do without hopefully being stabbed or having your life ended?
Let me first offer this object lesson in our most recent lawsuit that we filed. And this was filed in Whitefish, Montana. Our client in this case, Tanya Gersh, was the subject of repeated and relentless harassment by white supremacists. This gentleman's name is Andrew Anglin, who's the publisher of a hate site called The Daily Stormer. And right. He had called for a troll war against Tanya Gersh, and that is essentially harassment that happens online.
Right.
So she, Ms. Gersh, her husband and her 12-year-old son were relentlessly harassed through social media, on the phone. Anglin gave out their personal information. They received hate mail, hate emails, trolling across their social media platforms, and this went on for quite some time until Southern Poverty Law Center filed a suit about a couple of months ago. And so this is also new ground in that we're combating the harassment that is happening online.
Right.
I say that to say that there is a way to stand up. I mean, fortunately, the United States, you know, we have a constitution, we have a Bill of Rights, we have some, you know, civil rights protections that make it possible to sue individuals and hold individuals liable for violations of people's civil rights. Now, Yeah,
that was going to be that's something that I'm a little puzzled with. When you file these civil suits, what exactly is the charge?
Well, it depends. In this case in Whitefish, Montana, it's harassment, right?
Okay. I mean,
he knew that he would intentionally cause mental anguish by calling this troll war. He says that he maintains that, you know, I didn't tell. I told everyone to not behave in a violent manner. Well, you're still responsible for the psychological damage that you inflict on an individual when you harass them. And in Montana, they have an anti-harassment bill that allows us to use that as well. So you have to, you know, you have to kind of dig for the laws, but it's usually there when there's a violation of one's civil rights. Now, the example that you're talking about in Portland, and that really speaks more to bystander intervention.
Right.
And that's a very difficult thing. You know, we certainly applaud the courage of those young men who stood up for those young girls. And as we know, and I want to make clear to everyone, that one was 16 and one was 17. So what those gentlemen observed was a grown man harassing young girls.
Right.
And so they just tried to get him to stop, you know, in the most polite kind of way. But the perpetrator, Mr. Christian, was intent on reacting violently. He had a knife. He pulled it out and stabbed them. So we also know from our intelligence, our research tells us that, you know, there had been signs that he was going to behave violently.
Right.
He was at a rally earlier the month prior, rather, with a baseball bat. So you can look at his social media postings, and the local law enforcement was aware of him, but you never know when somebody's going to just completely explode.
Right.
So that's a difficult thing. It's very risky to intervene in those kinds of situations. I say that just to kind of state the obvious and make sure
realistic.
That people are aware, and you want to certainly first see to your own physical and mental safety first. That being said, most incidents it's safe enough to try to say something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what you want to do, what we recommend in terms of bystander intervention, is that you direct your attention towards the person being victimized,
right,
not the perpetrator. So you want to show your support for in this instance, those young girls. Maybe stand near them, you know, and just completely
basically ignore the person that's being.
That's right. You completely ignore the victimized
and just talk as if he's
that's
not
right.
there.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. And that's typically enough to. Now, this guy, though, you know, he could have been upset by that and still stabbed the people.
Right.
You know,
he could.
We just don't know. But that is our first recommendation, and that you never kind of directly engage the person that's doing the harassing.
Yeah, I think
remove the people that are being victimized from the situation.
But if I remember correctly, on that incident on the train, the train did stop, and they did try to remove him from the train. So they did sort of. Have I got that right?
Yes, but we wanted to remove the girls that were being victimized, right?
Right.
The authorities tried to remove him, but you know.
Yeah. Okay. So, any other advice you can give to people? I'm mostly interested in bystander intervention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just say again and underscore the fact that you want to help the person. You can act like there's a thing kind of like act like you know the person. Oh, you know, Kay. Oh, I haven't seen you in so long. So establish a relationship that has a dampening effect on the person that's being harassed, because they no longer see the person as just alone, right?
Right.
And so you just start talking to them and moving away at the same time. You know, you want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the strategy of, you know, trying to find an authority figure, someone in charge. But, you know, if you were with one or two people, one person would stay with the victim and one person would try to go get
right,
help.
Right.
The best possible advice is to try to remove the victim from the scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, we tell people that people often wait to see who's going to say something first. And everyone's waiting on the same thing. So if someone does just initiates any small strategy, it's oftentimes enough to deter the harasser.
Yeah, and to encourage other people to help too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I certainly appreciate the time you've taken to talk to us about this, and I really do admire the work you do.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
That was Leisha Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Kay Patrick, your host today. Thank you for joining us. Now it's time to hear some good news about a young person in our community who's won an award for her volunteer work. Our regular monthly guest, Kathy Hansen, Director for School Community and Media Relations for the Ames Community School District, is here to introduce this special guest to us.
It's my honor and privilege to introduce Katarina Bradley. She's going into eighth grade, and she has won an award from the youth. She won the Youth Volunteer Award, among other people, for her work fighting human trafficking. And Katarina has quite a story to tell about all the facets of the work she does, and I'm just going to let her tell you all about it.
And I'll just add, Katarina is here with her dad, Andy. So welcome to both of you, Katarina and Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let me just start by saying it's my honor to be here, and I'm so glad that I get to do my part in fighting this monstrosity known as human trafficking. So I guess my interest in the subject started when I first found the popular band For King and Country. They did a movie called Priceless about mixed several real stories about it. That really got me interested. I dug deeper and found that this really was what I wanted to devote my life to. Just so happens that my teacher decided that he was going to have us pretend, or do it for real, pretend to be entrepreneurs for a long project. So he said that this would count towards it. I started Beads Unbound. It wasn't called Beads Unbound at that time, but I started it then. We started by making some bracelets. We wanted to sell them around the school. My mom, when I first brought it up to her, she was like, well, maybe if they do let her in, maybe she'll make like $50. I'm very glad to say that we made $650 from donations from the school and its students. After that, those funds went to a trip to Mexico where I sent my father. And he went down into the red light zone in Mexico City to work undercover to find some girls and help rescue them from human trafficking. Sex trafficking, to be exact, in this situation. Once the trip was over, I decided I didn't want to stop. My whole family was very supportive of this endeavor from the beginning to the end. So I kept going with my with Beads Unbound. I renamed it Beads Unbound at this point. So then we decided that the best place we could do would be to just see where we could sell and sell the bracelets that we had made.
So you became quite an entrepreneur with this. Let's just take a small break for some music, and then we'll get you to tell us more about this business and how you developed it and how you make the bracelets.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back with Katarina Bradley, who won a Youth Volunteer Award for her work raising money to combat human trafficking. And she was, before we had the music break, she was just telling us how she made, how much was it, Katarina, by selling bracelets at your school?
$650, including a few donations.
Okay, and then you went on to develop this. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So after that, we just wanted to sell wherever we could. We sold some at a little rock thing. I'm not really sure what it was, but it was this little concert.
Anti-human trafficking event.
Yeah, it was an event. So
that was Andy, Katarina's dad, butting in there. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah, thanks, Dad. So then we were making way too many bracelets and kind of running out of places to sell. So and Mom decided that it was about time we made it legal. So we went to find some paperwork, and door after door was opened. Mom went to file out the paperwork. It was all in, the best way I can describe it is legalese. Uh-huh. A bunch of words that even she couldn't figure out. And that says something, because my mom is a trooper when it comes to figuring things out.
So this was paperwork to make your business into a nonprofit, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to ask your dad to explain that part a bit. You're not quite there yet, I believe.
Right. We're still working on officially becoming a nonprofit organization, but we do have our board of directors put together now. And so we're in the process of finishing all the, as Katarina so aptly put it, the legalese of officially filing for nonprofit organization status, which means we can no longer sell bracelets. Now we ask for donations and give bracelets as a thanks for the donations.
Right.
For
so
the
bracelets are a donation, or they will be.
Absolutely.
A donation, and people will give to the organization.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so nowadays we go to farmers markets, usually on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We haven't unfortunately been able to find one in Ames, but we have found them in
Jefferson and Roland.
Yeah, so we go there Tuesdays, Thursdays, just give bracelets, accept donations, all these kinds of things. We've gotten $50 to $100 a day these last couple weeks of doing that. We try to fulfill requests. So, like, people this last time requested a lot of turquoise and blue, so we're working on making a lot of those. So, yeah, that pretty much brings you up to speed.
Okay. Now, you make these bracelets yourself. I'd
yes.
like to hear a bit about what they're like.
Well,
you didn't bring one with you, did you?
Not unfortunately. I
okay,
hadn't
but
thought
she
of doing
does.
That. I always do, yeah. Oh, my purse is stuffed with bracelets instead of, well, lipstick, like most girls. So, well, they're hemp bracelets. Hemp is like a natural thread kind of deal. Lots of people used to wear them in, I guess, the like 80s, 90s area, but I think they're making a comeback. A lot of people are actually surprised at the beauty, if I do say so myself. There, we use macrame, a special kind of knot tying. Mostly use cobra knots, which is basically a square knot that makes it look like the thread is going back and forth in like a zigzag kind of pattern. My mom makes the more complicated ones. I make the simpler ones with more beads.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we do use beads. And we make a little loop at the top and a button at the bottom. The button goes through the loop and thus keeps the bracelet from falling off.
Okay.
Measurements are a thing, so we always keep measuring tape on hand, measure the wrists of our donors before we give bracelets for them to take a look at, and then they pick one. So,
mm-hmm. And they're basically one color in each bracelet, or multicolor?
It can be anything from uh-huh. one color to multicolor to
uh-huh. rainbow.
Rainbow, mm-hmm. yeah, we have made okay. a few rainbow ones. Not that we're okay. like gay.
They do sound very pretty, actually.
Some yeah, people like rainbows.
Nice. Yeah, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Yeah. So the bracelets are a nice hobby. That's if I do say so myself, they're functional.
Right. This is something you like to do as a hobby, and yet it's working in such a good cause.
I plan to keep this little nonprofit alive until I go through college. I'm planning on going to a college called Moody Bible Institute, which recently opened a section where students can major in human trafficking, learn about it, find out some stuff about it. I've already done some studies, but you know that will allow me to volunteer, maybe actually officially work in some bigger organizations and stuff.
Like, for example, the 27 million slaves worldwide, and that every 30 seconds, another victim of human trafficking.
Yeah. So my studies did confirm that information. Every 30 seconds, I still can't wrap my head around that. Every 30 seconds, another person somewhere in the world becomes a victim. Mm-hmm. And there are 27 million slaves in the world today. More than any other time in history.
Yes, and it's more than in the 19th century when it was legal to have slaves. It's very frightening.
It's more when there's illegal, less when there is legal. It's weird.
It is.
It's the second largest industry in the world, the second most money-making industry in the world, right behind illegal drug trafficking.
And it's so widespread, partly because of the globalized world and the people.
Yeah.
I mean, they're usually lied to and they're told that they've got a job and they're made a slave.
Middle-class people oftentimes are tricked into thinking they're going into a quote-unquote modeling business or acting, then are stuck in this situation and for emotional or physical reasons, they can't get out.
Oh, you're talking about sexual trafficking now.
Yeah, that's mostly sexual trafficking.
But there's labor trafficking as
right.
well.
And that's usually people who are foreigners, and perhaps in North America, they're in the country illegally, so they feel they've got no recourse. They often can't speak the language.
In some situations. Yeah. In others, the people are simply trapped because they can't find any other job.
Yeah.
So they think that this will get them a job, that this will get them the money they need, but most end up in the cruddiest situations you can imagine, sleeping under bridges, the whole cliche of poverty. They're oftentimes working 12 to 20 hours a day.
Yes, very exploitative.
Absolutely.
Conditions. Now, you're raising a lot of money. Could you give us some idea of how the money is used to combat trafficking? I mean, what is actually being done? Can you address that, Andy? And you were in.
Sure. As Katerina mentioned, I went down to Mexico City to meet up with some people down there who are helping to fight human trafficking. In Mexico City, there are over 70,000 prostitutes. And it's not like you see in Hollywood where a girl is just like, you know what, I think I want to raise some extra money. I'm going to sell my body. Only about 3% of prostitutes in the world fit that mold. Most prostitutes are forced into it.
Or they're underage.
They have a pimp. They're quite often underage. The average age of starting in Mexico was 14.
Yeah, because they're helpless, basically.
Roughly my age.
And one lady that they helped down there was almost 60 years old. She'd been in the industry for 40 years and doing 10 to 20 tricks a night. And she said when they told her she could get out of this, she said in 40 years is the first time anybody had ever told her that there was another option. And so one of the things now after that trip that we've been using the funds for is to help a place called Wings of Refuge, which is a local home here in Iowa that helps victims of human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And we also recently found out about Starfish, which is an organization that helps girls in China.
Yeah, not quite so local, but still is important.
We kind of have a passion for local, and I have a passion for just getting the word out and helping people understand what a problem it is, and the fact that, you know, for example, internet pornography, 70% of it is forced or coerced. So these guys that think, well, it's no big deal, I'm just, you know, I'm not hurting anybody by just clicking on some images, you're contributing to the human trafficking.
Right, right.
And 70% of it is forced.
And somebody had to be forced to have those pictures taken.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The rule of supply and demand, it works in legal and illegal situation. It applies just as much. Mm-hmm. Most people don't think about that. But when you think about it this way, by clicking on those things, you're giving supply.
Right.
Which you're giving demand, and other people are giving the supply.
Yep.
Right. That's a very good point. We should all remember that, Katerina. Yeah. Right. Now, why don't you tell us about the award that you got and about the ceremony in which you received the award?
To be fully honest, I'm pretty embarrassed to talk about it. But basically, we just got a actual handwritten letter in the mail that said we've been nominated. When I looked deeper into it, it turns out that the person that I had asked to sell in the school in the first place was the one who had nominated me, a man named
Dr. Anthony Jones.
Mm-hmm. He was the vice principal of my school and has now moved on to be principal in my old school, Fellows Elementary.
He actually has a new job. He's going to be the director of student services, helping all the programs that deal with at-risk students, English as a second language, and the school counselors. He's going to have a big new job that he's going to be very good at.
So anyway, he was the one who nominated me. When I first found out about it, I'll be perfectly honest, I had absolutely no idea what it was. So I looked into it. Turns out it's just this annual award. They pick out some kids from like kindergarten to high school, early college, that are contributing with success to the community. So apparently that included me. So I was very honored when I found out. I came fully nervous in a nice dress that I like to wear to special occasions. So there was a very nice dinner there, a good spread.
She received a certificate signed by the governor and a plaque.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they stood us up and explained what we were doing. At that point in time, it was just about the trip. I had recently moved on to the trying to raise money, all that kind of deal. But they mostly involved the trip to Mexico. Apparently struck a lot of hearts. And I gotta say, I don't think I'd be where I am right now if other people hadn't been moved by my work. And I can't even rightfully call it my work. I just gotta say I've been trying to lead this kind of movement, but I can't lead with no one to lead. So all donors, I'm just gonna shout out right now. Thank you, everybody who has helped me along the way. Thank you.
And people can contact you at beadsunbound@gmail.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So remember that. Beads Unbound. This is the name of this charity. It used to be a business. Now it's a charity.
Mm-hmm.
Beads Unbound by Katerina Bradley, a youth volunteer who's won an award for her work against human trafficking. And she's here with her dad today. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Today
Thank you for
coming.
The opportunity.
Thank you. This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a program where we explore the stories, people, and places of Central Iowa. And I've been your host, Kay Puttock. We've just been hearing from Katerina Bradley, winner of a Youth Volunteer Award. Earlier, we heard from Leisha Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center and Judge Robert Pratt of the Southern District of Iowa. And, of course, Alex Fafer from the Ames Historical Society. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear Local Talk online at khyfm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is also streaming live online at khyfm.org. Our theme music, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. So come and see if you'd like to join the Local Talk team. If you enjoyed this show, please tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. Right now, you should stay tuned for Democracy Now!, and that will be followed at 9 o'clock by Morning Masterpiece. So stay tuned for Democracy Now! And the headline news at the top of the hour. And please remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help to make it all possible. And now, thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.